This is the tax update for March 17, 2008. This week, CPA says error, IRS says method. The Tax Update podcast intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to determine items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use include using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. This podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Well, the issue this week is going to involve a question of the difference between what is a mathematical error and what's an accounting method. An issue whose answer was to determine the taxpayers in the case of Huffman versus Commissioner, a case decided by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals recently, sustaining the tax court's 2006 decision in this case. We'll look at the basic issue of what is a method of accounting, what are mathematical errors that are not methods of accounting, the difference between the two, and how the tax court in the Sixth Circuit analyzed which side of the divide the situation in the Huffman case fell on. Internal Revenue Code Section 446 governs the general rules for methods of accounting. And the general rule of Section 446A indicates that the taxpayer's taxable income shall generally be computed under the method of accounting the taxpayer uses to compute its income and keeping its books. Now, as we're all aware, there are some differences here, and there are some items where your method for keeping the books, if it's pure GAAP, is not going to agree with the tax law. But the general requirement is that we're going to follow how we keep our books, subject to the other restrictions the code applies. Section 446B provides that if a taxpayer has no method of accounting that has been regularly used, or the method does not clearly reflect income, the taxpayer shall compute its income under a method of accounting that, in the opinion of the IRS, does clearly reflect income. Section 446C goes on to provide us with a list of broadly available methods of accounting for a taxpayer, such as cash, accrual, and the like, while Section 446D provides that if a taxpayer is involved in more than one trade or business, each trade or business may use a different method of accounting. The code indirectly imposes a consistency requirement for methods of accounting used by a taxpayer. And taxpayers generally need the permission of the IRS to change their method of accounting. There are two provisions here at 446E and 446F. At 446E says a requirement respecting change of accounting methods. Notes that except as otherwise expressly provided in this chapter, a taxpayer who changes the method of accounting on the basis of which he regularly computes his income in keeping his books shall, before computing his taxable income under the new method, secure the consent of the secretary. And 446F tells us what happens if we fail to ask for that permission. If the taxpayer does not file with the secretary a request to change the method of accounting, the absence of the consent of the secretary to a change in method of accounting shall not be taken into account, one, to prevent the imposition of any penalty, the addition of any amount of tax under this title, or two, to diminish the amount of such penalty or addition to tax. Thus, once we have something that's identified as a method of accounting, we have to continue to use that method until such time as the IRS allows us to change that method of accounting. Note that while 446B gives the IRS the right to force taxpayers to change from a method that does not clearly reflect income, the provision does not allow a taxpayer themselves unilaterally to make a change from a method that does not clearly reflect income without complying with provisions that we find in 446E that the taxpayer secured the IRS's permission before making that change. Thus, a taxpayer who is using a method of accounting that is not permitted under the code, for instance, still must obtain the consent of the IRS in order to make that change. Nothing in Section 446 allows taxpayers to fix being on an impermissible method of accounting with the IRS. Now, we should note that the IRS does regularly publish and update automatic approval and non-automatic approval revenue procedures every so often. And last October, the IRS issued Notice 2007-88 proposing to revise those procedures. And the notice indicates are contained currently primarily in Revenue Procedure 2002-9 as modified by 2002-17, modified and amplified by 2002-19, and amplified, clarified, and modified by 2002-54. And Revenue Procedure 9727, as modified and amplified by 2002-19, as modified and clarified by 2002-54. So those are kind of the gamut of provisions that, until we get this new guidance, are going to govern the IRS's change of methods or change of procedures. Now, the IRS quite often gives us automatic methods of making changes that are either required by law, so we have automatic consent. Sometimes there are methods the IRS has allowed us to use. For instance, if the IRS decides that a method of accounting now can be used, many times they'll indicate a simplified method. They will grant taxpayers the right to automatically make that change by filing the 3115, the Request for Change of Accounting Method form, but not having to wait for the approval to come back. By the way, for those who aren't aware, the 3115 Request for Change of Accounting Method is the form that's generally used to request the permission of the IRS. Even if that permission is automatic, generally a 3115 still gets filed. Now, if we have a change of method, though, obviously how we compute income when we change from one method to another, accountants being what we are, we know that that would have, under the GAAP standards, we would have a cumulative effect of a change in position that would, and a change of accounting method that generally would impact our retained earnings, and we'd have a long-term catch-up on what the P&Ls would have been to date had we been using the other method. Internal Revenue Code Section 481A deals with the equivalent of the cumulative effect of a change in accounting method. And that provision says, in computing a taxpayer's taxable income for any tax year, referred to in this section as a year of change, if such computation is made under a method of accounting different from the method under which the taxpayer's taxable income for the preceding taxable year was computed, then there shall be taken into account those adjustments which are determined to be necessary solely by reason of the change in order to prevent amounts from being duplicated or omitted, except there shall not be taken into account any adjustment in respect of the taxable year to which this section does not apply unless the adjustment is attributable to a change in the method of accounting initiated by the taxpayer. Section 481B outlines a basic three-year spread mechanism for substantial changes, but then goes on to authorize the IRS to write regulations to generally govern the mechanic of implementing this section. And that reads under 481C, in case of any change described in subsection A of 481, the taxpayer may, in such manner and subject to such conditions as the Secretary may by regulations prescribe, take the adjustments required by A2 into account community tax imposed under this chapter for the taxable years or years permitted under such regulations. These provisions are needed because of the general rule that for taxes that each year stands on its own. We have an annual accounting system for taxes, along with the general limitation under the statute of limitation for the time for the IRS to assess a tax or for the taxpayer to file a claim for refund. And that runs for 3 years generally from the due date of the return or the date the return was filed, if it was filed on extension or after the due date. Sometimes it's not easy to determine what exactly is a method of accounting, and that's really our question for today. If it's not a method of accounting, we're not subject to Section 481. And such and the following items are not methods of accounting. For instance, an estimate. As we know from the recitation we find in Full Disclosure GAAP financial statements, accounting necessarily involves a number of estimates. If we simply have a modification of an estimate, that is not a method of accounting, but simply a change in estimate. So long as the method of computing the estimate produced a valid result in year one, that year can't be adjusted by the IRS, even if in year two we use a slightly different methodology, let's say, to come up with our required estimate. The taxpayer won't need permission to make such changes how to come up with the estimates for the return, so long as each estimate is reasonable standing on its own. The other thing that doesn't need to be permission is if we have mathematical or posting errors. If a taxpayer merely fouls up their books and manages to erroneously charge $100 of office supplies to federal income tax expense, that's not a method of accounting issue. Errors can be corrected via an amended income tax return. There's no need to get IRS permission to correct an error, unlike the need to get permission to change a method. Similarly, on examination, the IRS can force a taxpayer to recognize the effect of correcting this matter without having to clear the clearly reflects income hurdle it must to invoke Section 446B's authority to change a taxpayer's accounting method. Now, that latter category of what is a mathematical or posting error is key to the case of hand. Did we have a mathematical error or did we have a change in accounting method? Now, Regulation 446-1 contains much more details about what is and is not a method of accounting. In fact, that's a place you need to be looking when you're trying to figure out, do we have a method of accounting? The other regulations under 446 govern rather narrow areas, and obviously if you're in those specific areas, consult those regulations. But if the issue doesn't fall into the narrow areas, then the broad guidance of section of Regulation 1.446-1 is going to govern whether or not we have an accounting method and how we can make changes to that if need be. Regulation 1.446-1E2II contains the basic guidance on what is an accounting method, telling us indirectly how we determine if we have a method. And that states, and I'll quote, a change in accounting method of accounting includes a change in the overall plan of accounting for gross income or deductions or a change in the treatment of any material item used in such overall plan. Although a method of accounting may exist under this definition without the necessity of a pattern of consistent treatment of an item, in most instances a method of accounting is not established for an item without such a consistent treatment. A material item is any item that involves a proper time for the inclusion of the item in income or the taking of the deduction. Now, there's some key factors as we read that beginning part of the definition. The first key item involves the need to be material, which is defined, it involves the timing of inclusion. That's a key factor in what's an accounting method. It involves timing. The question of when we take a deduction or when we include amount in income is what gives us the concept of what is an accounting method. Methods determine when we bring stuff into income. Second, generally there's a need for a consistent treatment to establish a method of accounting, and that's probably, frankly, to view that as opposed to an error. We just fouled up this year versus we have a method. The question is, have we consistently used the same way of doing things? If we have, then we probably have a method if it affects the timing of inclusion of income. Now, the definition also, you may have noted, made clear, because it referred to material items, it's not just the overall method of accounting. You might get that feeling reading 446 initially that we're just talking about cash versus accrual. In fact, we're talking about that, but we're talking about a lot more. Specific ways of handling specific detailed line items on the tax return involve methods of accounting, so that we may look at specific computations and we need permission to change those ways of doing those specific computations. But the regulation goes on in B, Regulation 1.446-1B, to note that mathematical errors are accepted. It notes specifically that a change in method of accounting does not include correction of mathematical or posting errors or errors in the computation of tax liabilities, such as errors in computation of foreign tax credit, net operating loss, percentage of depletion, or investment credit. Also, a change in method of accounting does not include adjustment of any item of income or deduction that does not involve the proper time for inclusion of the item of income or taking the deduction. That, again, emphasizes the point that timing is a key determinant here. As well, mere mathematical errors don't establish a method of accounting. Rather, they are simply mathematical errors. But the question becomes, when we have something, what determines what's an error versus what's a method of accounting? Remember, clearly under our guidance, impermissible methods are still methods. You can argue that if the law doesn't allow you to compute income in this fashion, that's an error. That's not how it's viewed. It is viewed as a method of accounting if it affects the timing of income and we have the consistency. Generally, we have a method, even if that method is not one the law will allow. Now let's take a look at the Huffman case. In the case of Huffman versus Commissioner from the Sixth Circuit, 2008 TNT 449 for those with access to tax notes today, we have a group of auto dealers that used a variation on the LIFO method of accounting for their inventory for a large number of years. Each year, the same CPA had performed the computation of the LIFO inventory using a consistent approach that the CPA apparently believed agreed with the requirements in the regulation for the computation of LIFO inventory under the dollar value link chain LIFO method. Unfortunately, it turned out the CPA really didn't understand the method properly. And while we're not going to go into the details because this is not a lecture on dollar value link chain LIFO method, there is a specific step required in the mechanical computations outlined under this method in the regulations where an index must be applied to the increment computed. And the CBA never did this. He computed every year. He never used the index. That failure had the effect of understating the taxpayer's inventory each year, which means it had the effect of overstating cost of sales. And therefore, it caused income to be understated on a cumulative basis. He was showing less inventory on the balance sheet than inventory that would have been properly computed would have shown. That means cumulatively, there should have been more income recognized in the past on the prior year's returns. Mechanically, the differences would eventually wash out if the dealerships were to close down and get inventory to zero. But so long as the inventory stayed in business, a push forward of income that should already have been recognized in the amount of six figures existed for the four dealerships. Each of the four dealerships had an adjustment to inventory that was over $100,000. The taxpayers claimed that this was clearly a mathematical failure on the part of the CPA, who just failed to multiply, or essentially use an index of one, and that as such, the IRS could collect tax on difference of income for each of the 3 years that were open to assessment. But the difference in inventory that existed at the beginning of the period that was no longer open was simply a windfall of the taxpayer never to be taxed because the IRS had no right to assess tax back in those years. It was simply lost to recovery by the IRS. Similar as if the IRS had discovered that, oh yeah, back 5 years ago, we had apparently accidentally deducted $1,000 of non-deductible expenses as office supplies. Nice, the IRS knows that, but they don't get to recover that because they discovered the error too late. The IRS felt differently. The IRS claimed that the taxpayer's consistent use of a botched calculation was a method of accounting, one that wasn't allowed under the tax law, which did not clearly reflect income, but was a method nevertheless. It may have been a mistake, but it was a mistake that due to its consistent use became a method of accounting. Thus, in the IRS's view, Section 481 came into play, and the adjustment was taxable to the taxpayer, and we had to pick up the 481 adjustment, so we didn't get out of those prior closed years. The Sixth Circuit agreed with the tax court. The court noted that the change from the accountant's method of calculation of LIFO inventory to the proper application of the dollar value link chain method was the type of change that Section 481 was designed to capture, and the regulation's exclusion at Regulation Section 1.446-1E2IIB of a mathematical or computational area did not provide an exclusion for this transaction. The consistent application of the steps the accountants took to calculate the LIFO inventory took this beyond a mere mathematical error and into the realm of an accounting method. That is, had the accountant failed to apply the index 1 year, that would have been an error. However, the accountant failed to use this in any year, therefore it became an accounting method. The court notes that to define correction of a mathematical error to include correction in this case would lead to a contradiction within the regulation. In effect, the taxpayers argue that mathematical error arises any time there is a discrepancy between a computed value and the correct value. This definition would, for example, include the circumstances described in Example 6 in the regulations. As discussed, Example 6 of Regulation Section 1.446-1E2III describes a situation where a taxpayer consistently for a number of years improperly computed the value of inventory by omitting overhead costs. The taxpayer's error would thus be considered a mathematical error in the taxpayer's definition, yet the regulation provides that the correction of that error constitutes a change in method of accounting. The example thus implicitly rejects the idea that the mathematical error or computational error exception applies in those circumstances. The facts of the instant case are significantly analogous to Example 6 to warrant a conclusion that neither exception applies here. Now, the taxpayers attempted to find support for their position in the case of Corn Industries, which is a Court of Claims case from 1976, a case that the Sixth Circuit summarized in a footnote as noted. In Corn Industry, the Court of Claims held that a change in method of accounting had not occurred when a taxpayer for 4 years deviated from the method of accounting for inventory that it had previously used by omitting three items from its finished goods inventory. The three items were, however, included in the raw materials inventory, work in process inventory, and supplies inventory. The Sixth Circuit did not find this case equivalent. They had a couple of problems with it. The court noted the asserted inadvertence of the account's error is not relevant to determine whether there was a change in method of accounting. As a note, we taxpayers relied on the Korn case. Korn Industries, however, has been characterized by the Federal Circuit as a case of a posting error and thus is not directly relevant to the taxpayers' arguments regarding mathematical and computational errors. In any event, there's simply no basis in the text of Section 41 or Regulation Section 1.446-1 for a conclusion that inadvertence or intent is relevant to the inquiry of whether a change in accounting method has occurred. As the tax court noted in Superior Court of Florida, Inc. versus Commissioner, 1983 case, to the extent that Korn Industry provides an exception for Section 41 for the correction of good faith mistakes, commentators have questioned the authority for such an exception. Indeed, such considerations are inconsistent with the very purpose of Section 41, to allow for all adjustments necessary to prevent amounts from being omitted or duplicated as a result of a change in accounting method. Now, from a practical standpoint, we tend to run into this matter quite often when we inherit a new client. You will often take over a client whose previous accountant, or maybe they didn't have a previous accountant, there's been a method of reporting that's not allowed under the code. Maybe their method has been miscomputed. You have to determine, do we have an error where they just fouled up? Do we have a method of accounting? And are we going to need to go through the permission sequence? Note, it is important to determine properly. If you do not file for permission for a change in accounting method, and it is determined what you had was a method, the IRS is perfectly justified in kicking you back to the old method, even if that method is erroneous. The IRS is also perfectly eligible to move you to the method. So you may have to tell the taxpayer, essentially, that we need to file for the permission to change a method. As well, the good news is if the method's erroneous and it's in the taxpayer's favor, when we change to the one we should be using, we can get that benefit. If it was not a method but an error, we lose it if we have closed years. I mean, what's good for the IRS is, unfortunately or fortunately, good for us. So the same issues arise. Remember, the key factor tends to become, was it done consistently? And does this ultimately affect the timing of income? If the answer to both of those is yes, and by consistent, we generally mean we've done it for two or more years, and we've done it in a manner that has been done consistently over that time, and it affects timing, we have a method of accounting. And once we have it, we can't move off without the permission of the IRS. This has been the Tax Update for March 17, 2008. As always, the Tax Update is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to visit them and take a look at their newsletters of interest to tax professionals. This has been the Tax Update.